Welcome, everybody, to this week's bonus episode of Left Reckoning. Last week was a very, very eventful week in Brazilian politics. We were joined by Brian Mayer to break down what's happening in Brasilia, but we also want to make sure that you had a chance to hear from our good friend and comrade and journalist, Victor Pucci, who is joining us now. How's it going, brother?
Hi, Matt. Hey, David. I always say Matt first, even though you were the person who asked. hey, Matt. As always, a pleasure to join. Hope you guys are doing well.
Yeah. We're really happy to have you. And I'm really excited for this conversation. So in just a little bit, we're going to be talking about this really great piece in the new Left Review, which I posted earlier this week for people to check out if they were interested. But we're, you know, no need to read the piece if you haven't already. We're going to sort of just be working off some of the bigger quotes from it. But before we get to this piece in the new Left Review, I was just hoping to do a little bit of housekeeping. And Victor, could you sort of let people know what's happened post this big rally in Brazil? Because basically, for folks who remember, there's this massive protest in Brasilia. As Brian Mayer put it, you know, there was no coup, but the real coup was sort of convincing people like that something like that could potentially happen, right? That was in the moment. Bolsonaro got a lot of pushback and, in fact, sort of had to apologize to folks. Could you sort of take people through the events of last week, kind of overview style?
Yeah. I'm going to just fast track through the stuff that actually happened on the protest day, because you guys have covered it quite well in the episode with Brian. Just going to do very quick contextualization, just so I don't, you know, start from the middle. But September 7th is the Independence Day of Brazil, and a day in which people who think themselves patriotic like to go on the streets and you know, watch military parades and stuff like that. And it was the day that was planned, a huge demonstration in favor of Bolsonaro, which was a culmination of weeks of escalating rhetoric by Bolsonaro against other branches of power. He has successively picked fights with state governors, with Congress, and with the Supreme Court, you know, in addition to all the other fights that he's picked. But these are important because they are, you know, they have to do with the constitutional order of the country, and Brazil being a very young democracy with relatively weak checks and balances, and having had a tradition of coups, it really is concerning. And then after weeks of this escalating rhetoric, there was this protest that was meant to be a show of force by Bolsonaro and his supporters for September 7th. And it was, they were quite big protests. Like, I'm not going to pretend they were small. It was a lot of people on the street, but it was probably less than people were expecting, imagining, and in case of Bolsonaro and his supporters, hoping. They really did push this one, kind of went all in on promoting, you know, having people go from other cities to the central ones. And they were hoping to do a big show of force to say, you know, kind of show the other powers that, you know, the executive is super strong and is going to railroad everyone. You're either with us, either against, or you're against us. And, you know, there were fears that coup segments of the military would join Bolsonaro, although that was more up in the air because the army is a little bit more complicated. And even though they are full on behind Bolsonaro's government, it doesn't quite seem like they see the value. And, you know, they have all the power they want now without having to actually be in power. So there's just no incentive for them to do a coup. The military police, which are each state have their own, are also super pro Bolsonaro. And that's where most of the fear was concentrated. But it was kind of a dud. It didn't quite happen as people thought it might have. Although, as Brian Collective pointed out, the fact that there wasn't a coup kind of just shows that the coup was, you know, just injecting this possibility,
the idea, the threat
of democracy. Now we're all working with the possibility that the military might take over, and now whenever there's some political thing, happening, political crisis happening, people go and ask what the generals are thinking. Mm-hmm. While in reality, it shouldn't matter what the generals think about whatever it is. They shouldn't, like, military coups should not be on the table at all.
Right.
But whatever, I digress. There was these protests, and particularly in Brasilia and in Sao Paulo were the two biggest ones, the one they were kind of like going all in. Bolsonaro attended both. In Sao Paulo, he made quite a fiery speech, basically saying that any decisions coming from the Supreme Court made by this specific judge that is his enemy, mm-hmm. We will not obey, which, you know, is plainly anti-democratic and kind of like showing that he wasn't willing to play by the rules of the game. You know, there's all this stuff with him casting doubts on the electoral system, blah, blah, blah. We've gone through this before in the other episode I was in. I'm sure Brian has also touched on it. You guys have been covering it, so it's not going to be news for anyone. Anyone who's interested in finding more about that can just check that out. But it was kind of like the culmination of this plan, and it wasn't quite strong enough as Bolsonaro would have needed it to be. So on the next day, as people read it as kind of a moment of weakness for Bolsonaro, in the sense that he wasn't as strong as he hoped to be, but also that he had kind of turned a corner that, you know, you would think you can't turn back from, he was left in quite an awkward position of having gone too far to kind of be welcomed back into the institutions as if he were a regular, you know, rules-abiding politician. But he had also gone not far enough to maintain the loyalty of his most extreme supporters. Mm. So he was kind of in this very, very awkward, uncomfortable situation for him. And, you know, whenever Bolsonaro's in an awkward, uncomfortable situation, all of us are in a happy, comfortable situation. So everyone was kind of like hoping that something finally would happen. But then Bolsonaro's biggest coup, his biggest trump card, was that after having basically pulled it as far as it gone and to the point of rupture, mm-hmm. He summoned the help of our well-known vampire or butler.
He looks like a vampire, too.
He's like the butler on an Avatar movie. Yeah. Michel Temer, former president, who was the vice president to Dilma Rousseff, and ousted her. You know, he was basically the main guy pulling the strings behind the coup. And he's kind of like the love in the eyes of the neoliberal centrist, but rather right-wing elites that, you know, think what Brazil really needs is austerity. And, you know, it's a project that has a significant cachet in Brazilian elite circles, in media, in, you know, business, among business people. But it just has no popular support whatsoever. These guys would never have won an election. That's why they hitched their wagon into the coup that Temer did. They also then hitched their wagon onto Bolsonaro because, you know, while Bolsonaro was not quite a creature of their kind, Bolsonaro is very different to all these centrist, you know, plain-spoken, good haircut, nice suit kind of guys. But, you know, he was willing to do whatever he wanted, and they entered into an easy alliance with him. And it seemed like the market and we were ready to ditch Bolsonaro because, you know, like creating a political crisis every second day is not good for business, even if he's willing to privatize anything, everything, you know. It's just at some point it causes trouble. So where it seemed like we're at the point of rupture between Bolsonaro and these market actors, Temer came to the rescue. And then on the day after the September 7th protest, obviously September 8th, Bolsonaro sent a private jet out to pick him up, bring him to Brasilia. And he basically wrote a letter that Bolsonaro signed, in which he basically kind of like pretended to apologize and was like, well, I said all these things, but you know how we get when we're making a speech. I don't
get excited.
And, you know, it seems like a sector of these neoliberal elites are more than happy to bite once more. Mm-hmm. Although the chessboard has certainly changed. He is making another plea to maintain these guys in the fold of his coalition. I think he is betting that they can find a better alternative to him, at least between now and the election, so they won't impeach him. And I think he's just hoping to survive until the elections. And if he does, you know, and he gets in a position to contest the next election as a president, he gets to do a lot of mischief and cause a lot of trouble in the next elections. So this is kind of where he's going for. I think what I think it's important to say is that there is in the international press, in the business press, but even in the business press in Brazil, the kind of press that those guys who love Temer would read, this was treated as like Temer saved Brazilian democracy. But what it seems to me is that he saved the Bolsonaro government from Brazilian democracy. Mm-hmm. Because the way I see it, had democracy been allowed to play itself out, you know, the institutions would have reacted to this crazy, you know, round of Bolsonaro authoritarian escalation. But Temer kind of like froze it in place. So the conflict is just kind of playing out in super slow motion now. So all the problems are still there. But the facade of calm is sturdy enough so that these market guys can do their business well enough, mm-hmm. in a way.
That can't make the far right guys happy, though, I imagine, right?
They're not. So basically, Bolsonaro and his guys are basically doing the trusted process thing. Like Bolsonaro is playing.
Right.
National chess, and you think he's doing it something bad, but actually he's super smart and he's doing what we want, you know. I mean, he just can't tell you. Yeah,
right.
And we've learned that from President Trump. I mean, he's been playing the long game. November 6th of 2021, he's actually officially going to be inaugurated president of the United States of America after the fake elections are revealed.
It's exactly that. It's the same thing.
I mean, we did this last time. I think we did it with Brian as well, too. It is sort of fascinating to see the parallels of like that kind of strategy.
Before we talk about the left, though, what do you think about if Bolsonaro loses control of the right? What does the future of the right, like what prognosticate on the right for us a little bit?
Okay, so the center-right, which was basically, since Brazil redemocratized, the first elections were kind of like up in the air, a little bit more complicated than that. But basically, we have a polarization between a party of the center right and a party of the center left. This is how most elections have been. It was in 2018. It wasn't in 2018. Sorry, it's an exception that I'm going to try to go over now. But 2014 was like that. Second round between Dilma and ISU. 2010, 2006, 2002, these four with the center-left with PT winning. The two elections before that were with the center-right winning, but basically every round, second round of voting was between the party of the center-right and the party of the center-left. In 2018, PT bled a lot of votes. It was definitely the worst electoral year for the party. Since pre-democratization, I would wager definitely in the last 10, 15 years. But what happened is that PT got to the second round of vote with just about 42%, you know, within the same margin that it was expected and you know, you could have expected. Even with Lula being in jail and all the crazy stuff that was going on, the center left kind of like remained in place as a force, but the center right utterly collapsed. In my reading, it has to do with their disastrous impeachment project with Temer, in which they went, you know, all in. And there were within that center-right party, the PSDB, there were sectors. The party was divided between the kind of guys who were like, no, let's fuck it, let's go with impeachment, get rid of Dilma now. And the other guys were saying like, dude, just let her, like, she's super unpopular. Let her term play out and we're going to emerge as the triumphant winners in the next term. And I think those latter guys were probably right, but they were defeated internally. And they did this impeachment, you know, we're kind of like in power now, even if in this roundabout way. But what happens is that everyone that was associated with this government was just super, super unpopular, including Temer. As popular as he is with these pundits and with these businessmen, it's just like no one wants any of this shit. And then the center-right utterly collapsed. So, and the vacuum of the center-right, Bolsonaro blossomed in a way and stole the air. With Bolsonaro deflating back again, you would think that they would be able to re-merge. And it's still kind of hard to know what's going to happen. But they just have no project because their project, they cast aside in favor of the impeachment. Impeachment went terribly. Next elections came around. They also did terribly. All their traditional leaders are super unpopular or are like involved with corruption. They're trying to like manufacture, you know, in the fucking like petri dish in the basement of some like international conglomerate, trying to like manufacture like the perfect suit and haircut combination. They can run. They're trying it with this guy now who is a governor in the southern state. He's gay, he's young, you know, trying to do this like progressive neoliberal shtick, but it's probably not going to stick. I don't think he's too young. He's not known nationally. There's just not enough time to put him in front of enough. I think maybe I'm wrong, right? But that's how it seems to me. And they kind of don't really have any identity. So what we see is that we have Lula and Bolsonaro in every poll. Lula like first, super ahead. Bolsonaro second. And the third name that appears is a guy that's usually associated with the center left. He's a center left guy. He was a minister in Lula's government. Interesting guy. One day we can talk about him more deeply. His name is Ciro Gomes, Ciro in English, if anyone is interested in looking him up. He is, you know, like super technocratic left wing, center left kind of guy, like, but, you know, he comes from a very specific tradition that I don't think we'll have enough time or space to get into now. But he's a guy of the center left who is making a play for the center and the center right. So he's kind of like moving right a little bit. Not a little bit. He's moving like doing a center right to center left, like mishmash platform. But he's going all his... He's doing the anti-Lula thing. So they used to be like close allies. But he's like, you know, hitting Lula because he needs to polarize with Lula, right? It's clearly going to be Lula against someone else. And the kind of people who are still with Bolsonaro are the kind of people who really, really hate Lula. And I think what his idea is, and as much as I dislike it politically, because, you know, I don't think it's good to attack like Lula gratuitously like that, you know, considering that he was a great president and all this stuff. And, you know, it kind of like offends my sensibilities, perhaps, in a way. But I also think it's a clever maneuver because these guys are with Bolsonaro. They're not going to like jump Bolsonaro to a guy who like hangs out with Lula.
Right.
So he's like, but it's hard for him because they were allies for so long. But that's what he's doing, and it seems to be kind of working. Like the idea of a third way, you know, that's not Bolsonaro or Lula, was mocked for a long time, including by me, because it was always in the head of these guys who are just disconnected with reality. They don't understand that what they're selling no one wants. And I think that Ciro is able to kind of break through that because he's selling something totally different. And he already has name recognition from like decades of being a politician. He's like popular. He's super smart. Like, and he's like angry, you know, he like, he yells at people sometimes. So he's like authentic and stuff. So there's a possibility, although I don't want to be making predictions so far out and with conditions so cloudy. Like in the midst of this fog, but it, there's a non-trivial possibility, which seems to be the most likely scenario, that the third force after Bolsonaro and Lula will be from the center left.
Interesting.
No, it's fascinating. It's going to be a really, I don't know, ideologically crowded space. And we're definitely going to be having more conversations sort of breaking it down in the future. I want to spend maybe, you know, we have a little bit of time sort of
that, Matt. One last interesting thing about Ciro is that it has been reported, you know, obviously I wasn't there. I can say, but I do trust the people who reported. One guy who came out and explicitly said this on the record is a guy called Roberto Mangabeira Unger. He's a Brazilian philosopher, but he's like, you know, he's like a big brained kind of guy. I think he teaches at Harvard, has some interesting works. Some's a bit wacky. And he's a close aide to Ciro Gomes. And he has said that he has come out and said that Lula offered to Ciro the position that was ultimately Haddad got of being the VP on Lula's ticket. And once Lula was inevitably arrested, he would lead the ticket. And he didn't want, he didn't agree to it. Like, I'm not going to pretend like, oh, he just didn't want it. Like, I'm sure there's like a million like competing conditions and things to complicate the matter a little bit, but you can see how they were close once and how awkward it is to see like they and Lula of course is also in a very politically savvy way, is not like responding to anything, just like ignoring, pretending it doesn't exist, and just like, whenever he's directly asked about it, he just says, Ciro is my friend, like I hope we can get along better again in the future. Of course, like, because Ciro is really fighting for airspace, so Lula is kind of like deny that. Yeah,
that's funny.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I mean, a lot of these kind, I mean, Lula just sort of being you know, opening up that door, I think is fascinating, and it's interesting to see a similar sense with like PSOL, right, and with a lot of left movements regarding Lula, and I think, you know, just time wise, there's a few things in this text I think are worth sort of bringing up so people can check, you know, like tease it a little bit, get them interested in it. This is a piece in New Left Review. Thanks, Matt. Which, again, if people aren't familiar with New Left Review or listeners, this is a really great resource.
I think last time I was here, we recommended the Perry Anderson book.
Yes.
Which is also a product of the New Left Review Extended Universe.
Yeah, and, you know, and it's interesting. I mean, not to get too bogged down on this stuff, but like, you know, people do know, you know, should know that there are these different tensions, right? Leo Panitch and those folks, they have had a competing journal called Socialist Register, which is also very good. Anyways, these are these kind of things. These are these kind of things. Yeah, competition. These are these kind of things that are just worthwhile. You know, if you're sort of, you know, a newer leftist and, you know, you don't haven't been introduced to these things, these are really great places to start. Anyway, this is a long text and there's a lot of really interesting things in this interview. This is an interview with, and let's see if I can get this right, Guilherme Boulos, right? Yeah. Okay. Who is a very fascinating guy. He ran in 2018 for president on the PSOL ticket. He also ran in 2020 for mayor of Sao Paulo, which from my understanding was, you know, fairly, you know, successful for his run and, you know, for what the kind of movement that he represents. But this piece is called Struggles of the Roofless. He is a member of the MTST, which is, you know, a group of essentially homeless workers. He's a really fascinating, political and, intellectual figure. And I don't know. I mean, like, there's a lot of things in this text. I mean, maybe it might be better if you could just like just sort of briefly give people in the U.S., myself included, a better flavor as to like who he is and how he's understood. And then we can get to some of the text, because I do think like his way of thinking and his personal intellectual history is really like universally teaching for a lot of people. It can help a lot of people understand how to engage in politics.
Yeah. So he is associated with the MTSC, the movement of, in a literal translation would mean the roofless workers. So people with no roofs, mm-hmm. obviously people with no houses, which is kind of a sister movement and a kind of was born from the midst of the landless workers movement, which is obviously, you know, the landless rural workers, basically campesinos, mm-hmm. That, and it's, you know, obviously a rural phenomenon. This social movement is obviously a social movement that happens in the country, because these are, you know, land workers, people who work the earth, work the land. With Brazil's boom in urbanization, starting in the 80s, but particularly in the 90s, perhaps, we saw that a lot of the energy of the, there was a phenomenon called the rural exodus, mm-hmm. in which all the landless rural workers were trying to, which is where, you know, throughout most of Brazilian history, most of the population was destitute people living in rural environments, but who don't have their own land to farm. And, you know, Brazil has always had the distinction of being an enormous food producer and food exporter, with an enormous amount of starving people at home. Anyway, I digress a little bit.
That's fascinating.
With the rural exodus or quick urbanization, we saw kind of like this phenomenon migrate to the cities, which is basically kind of the same thing, lumpen proletariat, mm-hmm. proletariat, if we update it to an urban nomenclature, perhaps. That kind of like organized in a similar fashion. Instead of, you know, occupying unproductive land, they occupy empty buildings, basically, to live there. Kind of like squatter movements.
Yeah, squatting, yeah.
Guilherme Boulos is a guy that comes from the upper middle class, which is often an euphemism for being rich in Brazil. Like, you know, middle class person would probably be like in a top 5%, you know, like what is like commonly talked about as middle class. If you like put it, organize it graphically, we'll see that's definitely not a middle class, but rather a top class. It's just not the super rich, whatever. He came from that, and when he was like 16 or 17 or what have you, he had a political awakening, and he kind of like got involved with this, you know, and I think this is something that he narrates in first person in the interview, and I'm not going to do justice to it, but you know, he was basically kind of fed up with you know, the injustice of, you know, being rich and comforted in a city so full of people like literally living in the streets. And you know, he tells a story of you know, he's coming from school and there was a homeless guy he always saw, and you know, they kind of had a rapport, he'd always give him money or whatever. And then, you know, he got home and then there was like a huge enormous storm, and you know, as he saw the rain outside, he thought of the guy living in the streets. And then that's kind of like he got involved with that. I also think he originally was involved with the PCB, the Communist Party mm-hmm. of Brazil. And he's an interesting guy for, you know, several reasons, because he has a very solid academic like background in left politics. He, you know, which is something that, for example, Lula never had, right? He didn't like arrive to politics with an academic study like the reverse, right? Like even today, probably he's too like a million times intuitive and less
man of action.
Yeah. And I mean like whatever, like all the books I've read in my life and you guys like added together are now like 1% of the experience that he has. Right. But I don't even know where I was going with this.
I mean, he has a good background in theory, and he's very educated.
And he is he was involved with this movement, and from there, that's where his political life, his political career was built on. He started to get more famous maybe in the last five to 8 years, perhaps. Mm-hmm. When he joined PSOL, he left the Communist Party of Brazil, which is basically like, I don't mean to diss like my comrades of the left, like I respect the work everyone does, and you know, I certainly consider the Communist Party to be my allies and my friend, but you know, it's it can be derisively called more of a study group than a party by some people. Mm-hmm. And it seems like Boulos was looking for more of a, you know, a more vibrant, perhaps. I don't know. I'm trying to like
project. I mean, it's like it's a left wing party. It's very critical. I mean, it's you know, it's a left wing party out of power, right?
Yeah, but a small one.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, a left wing party out of power in the sense that, like, we have a lot of left wing parties out of power. They're nowhere as big as PSOL, right? You know, there's yeah, I mean, it's a left wing party as like like you read the positions of it. I could definitely see a situation in my life, you know, being a member of it if I were to be Brazilian.
They're right in politics. It's just not like their political outlook is probably correct in most things. It's just not a significant force in Brazilian politics anymore. It used to be enormous, and basically, like, it's in the situation that it is now of not being that relevant a force in Brazilian politics, because basically they were all killed and murdered and disappeared during the dictatorship. It's not like, oh, they suck, that's why they're tiny. Yeah. I'm just like trying to explain that, you know, they are small. But.
Well, I mean, and also, I mean, and I think we can maybe start jumping into the text a little bit here. I mean, one of the big lessons, and like, you know, I think, by the way, I feel like this is going to be more of like an open discussion between, you know, all of us just about some of the ideas that get brought up. So feel free to chime in anytime. But like, one of the big lessons that we're at in 2021 is like, you know, we see the big movements. So like in Brazil, PT is good. We see movements here in the US, and we're trying to figure out how to participate in them, how to mold things, and how to build, you know, working class power across the board. Right. So, you know, coming at groups for their size, I don't think you know, we're not slamming anybody. We're just trying to understand where things are coming from. But the thing that's interesting about him as well is that, you know, he's not just, for people in the US who aren't familiar with these things, like, he's not just PSOL, right? You know, as a member of this very radical movement, I mean, this is on the ground kind of stuff, which I think one of the bigger lessons that I think that he really has to teach us in the US is that, like, Brazil is fascinating because, you know, we have a lot of kind of similarities and certainly a lot of differences. But one thing that is very vibrant in Brazil, I think, compared to the US, is like there are all these kind of like alternative movements or alternative organizations, right? From the landless workers to MTST, right? And I think that would be something that would probably be beneficial for us to be able to replicate on some level here. But maybe to get to the text a little bit, I wanted to open this up. And
I just want to, like, before we do that, I just want to contextualize what PSOL is, which is a small left-wing party. I mean, small in the context of PT, but, you know, in the context of PCB, the Communist Party we're just talking about, it's quite big. So it's all relative. PSOL is a party that some people in the US might already be familiar with, Marielle Franco.
Let's see,
who was murdered, was a member of that party, as is David Miranda, Glenn Greenwald's husband. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of interesting left-wing characters. They were a distance from PT that you know, broke away from PT's left, angry at the neoliberal accommodations that PT seemed to be excessively willing to get into. And it was kind of like, for a long time, and this is something people in PT would disdain about, right? It was like a party of teachers, university students, and unions of government workers, right? Mm-hmm. It was like postal workers and you know, national bank unions, university students, university teachers, that was kind of like the base that, you know, fairly or unfairly, a little bit of both, people who are criticizing it would point to that and say that. When Bolus went to PSOL, it was an interesting phenomenon because it was when a connection between PSOL, which is a left-wing party, is like, it's not just that, right? I'm being very stereotypical, right? And it's got like this vibrant, it's got a lot of young people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to come across as if I'm like, again, like, yeah, shitting or whatever. Right. I'm like, you know, telling you what the criticism is. Not that you should agree with it or believe it, but whatever. I think what was interesting with Bolus joining them is because when finally, like, mass politics were kind of like, and PSOL kind of like fused together, right? Not everyone in MTSD is in PSOL, not everyone in PSOL is in MTSD, but I and other commentators see this MTSD PSOL rapprochement as perhaps a change, qualitative change in the history of PSOL when, you know, it kind of really penetrated the masses, right? And left the academic bubble into people who are legit doing politics, like around the city and stuff like that. But yeah, Bolus ran in 2018 for president in that party, and it was controversial because for a lot of the old guard of PSOL, there was like just a new guy doing entryism, and like the people who were originally in PSOL who broke with BT see like Bolus being on Isolula and like, fuck you, like we've created this party because we wanted to get away from these problems, and now you're dragging us back into it. Was like a little bit dramatic, but it seems like now they're, you know, they've worked it out. Bolus is well at home in PSOL, ran for president last election, but couldn't really break through. Like, everyone that would have voted for him probably voted for Lula, but he was known for being and this also generated controversy within PSOL, in which that basically he used his candidacy to denounce the fact that Lula couldn't be a candidate, right? His idea was like, I'm a better left-wing candidate than Lula. I think like my party, you know, is better than PT, but I should be debating Lula and telling him that. And, you know, the fact that, you know, the powers that be kept him from running. And so basically, you know, his candidacy was more of a defense of Lula than, you know, critics would say, than anything else. But then in 2020, he ran for mayor in Sao Paulo and was expected just to be another fringe candidate and was able to build like really deeply. And it was the reverse phenomenon that I just described, in which the PT candidate really didn't do quite well because it seems that most of the PT voters ended up voting for him. And the guy that ran with PT when Bolus went to the second round, the guy was like all in on Bolus, right? There was like some fear that, you know, he'd be like angry of having had, but, you know, and then PT and PSOL also lied very, which is also something different because for a long time, there were bitter rivals, right? One was the factor and the other was like the, you know, old, decrepit like party that like is become neoliberal, and the PSOL PT guy said PT, the PSOL guys saw PT as that, having, you know, aged and decrepit. And PT saw PSOL as like a bunch of like young Trotskyites who are just like ideological wanking and now, you know, don't really do anything. But now it seems like they're seeing eye to eye and happy to, or at least willing to make alliances, which is super interesting. And hope that this is something that we'll carry on. Anyway, into the Bolus interview.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely interesting. The developments are really exciting for this. And like, yeah, I mean, like, I highly suggest people read this entire interview. I just wanted to note, I think there's really two places that we'll land on, right? Which is him talking about leaving the Communist Party. And I'll just say, like, you know, I grew up in the U.S., so these weren't things that I experienced. I don't know how familiar you are with the CPUSA, the Communist Party of the U.S., Victor. But it's like a shell.
I know it's got 20 members and 25 are CIA.
Well, not only that, it's like it's got like 200 members and like, you know, yeah, they're almost all CIA. But honestly, like I will say there are some people who are members of the Communist Party who are actually like very smart and committed folks. But it ceased to be, you know, in the United States, if you like sign up to be a member of the Communist Party, you can't get certain government jobs. You have to report that when you re-enter the country, right? You deal with a lot of shit to be a member of the Communist Party. And in 2016, the Communist Party endorsed Hillary Clinton, right? And it's just one of those things that's like not, and like not just like tacitly like, oh, Trump's a bigger evil. They actually, like their theoretical documents, I'm sorry, this is a digression, but it is interesting. Their theoretical documents argue that to create the conditions to build socialism, we need to create like essentially a one-party state with the Democratic Party, completely destroy the Republican Party, and then like we'll go into a radical struggle with like the Democrats. To me, absolutely insane. And I couldn't imagine, you know, putting myself through the shit that you go through to be a member of the Communist Party officially in the US today, to just basically be a booster to Democrats. Anyway. Yeah.
You ended up just being Democrats, but like,
no, that's the plan.
What is funny when Republicans are like, you know, the communists love the Democrats, and most of them are like, no, we hate them. But anyways, I'm talking very surface level, because again, like there are some really committed members of CPUSA whose work I very much respect, and I don't want to shit on too much, but this is
like
why
me, Hillary Clinton.
This is why I'm not a member, and this is why I don't point people to join it. But anyways, in another universe, in another country, I probably would have also been a young communist militant as well, right? This would have been an organization I would want to join. And I think his sort of quick line here about leaving the party is interesting. And then I want to go down a paragraph to some stuff about theory, which is cool. He says, why did you leave? Talking about leaving the basically the youth wing of the Communist Party. I began to see a contradiction between the doctrinal position of the party speaking in the name of the people and it's not being willing to build something with the workers themselves. It was a vanguardist idea, detached from reality. I began to understand that if we wanted to work towards a broad social transformation, it was more coherent to build something that directly involved the popular layers. It wasn't just my decision. And then he goes on to note that other people joined him. Some of us who made the decision to join, to leave, you know, joined the MTST. The struggle of Sem Tito, those without a roof, because it expressed the extreme of Brazilian poverty, those without even a place to rest their head. And unless anyone has anything to say there, I think this is a really interesting like tension or a point here, right? So he mentions there about leaving the party because of its sort of, you know, vanguardist approach in the sense that like it wasn't rooted. The terms that we like to use, Victor, are class focused versus class rooted. I don't know if you've heard those before, but like, you know, very different movements, right? So leaving the Communist Party, which was focused on the class, but wasn't rooted in it, to become a member of a rooted movement. And then I want to note this, because the next few bits, next few paragraphs, he's sort of going through though his theoretical bona fides, right? The fact that he has like a master's in like, you know, psychoanalysis, and he's reading Hegel and stuff like that. So like the point about, the reason I find this interview interesting, and I think is useful for our audience in the US, is like, there's a lot of debates in the US between like practical, like between theory and like practical education. Right. And I find this to be a really fascinating kind of synthesis, right? Where like there was a rejection of a kind of like theory for theory's sake, but then a kind of embrace for theory as a tool. But anyways, let me read the quote here. How would you compare being a militant in the UGC, again, which is like the youth wing of the Communist Party, and in the MTST in practical and theoretical terms? They're radically different. As a party militant, at least as I experienced it at the time, the main task was to convince people of the justness of the party's program. It's talking about the Communist Party. There was an extreme, almost idealistic valorization of theory. You could even call it naive, thinking that you already have the answers and that producing social transformation is just a matter of making the whole working class aware of these truths. In the popular movements of the MTST, militancy comes from people's practical experience, from their concrete struggle for housing, which from a doctrinal party perspective might be seen as a corporatist, purely economic struggle without the potential to transform social and political structures. In this respect, a great lesson that I learned in the MTST is that any transformation has to come from concrete objective conflicts, and that the practical organizational construction of social and political coexistence is more important than an abstract program. No matter how successful a program may be, the building of a movement is subject to the contradictions of real life, and the program changes in interaction with the community.
It's good. Sound stuff, man.
I mean, I think that I'm just curious if y'all have any thoughts on that, but like, especially you, Matt, just because I find like, it's like, I just feel like this is a kind of thing that we're sort of dancing around here and sort of butting heads into people with, because again, for people who haven't read the entire interview, like the rest of the interview is about like Hegel and like psychoanalysis, right? It's not like a kind of thing of saying like, oh, the theoretical aspects of the party program don't matter, but rather what is the class doing? Right. Mm-hmm. Where are the people? What are the tensions? What are the walls that they're hitting up against in their life?
I mean, we had a question today on MR about like, was it naive to think just focusing on certain policies would be able to like swing a Democratic presidential primary? And I think the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Like Bernie's had the greatest policies. And at a certain point, like that's not just having that isn't enough.
Without a doubt. And, you know, also I think from, you know, later in the piece too, he sort of goes through the practical way that the MTST is set up. And it's one of those things, like as a member, if you're not homeless and you want to be a member of the movement, you can do things that are like, you know, all these different kind of very practical corps, right? Corps that you can join to like, fight with folks, but included in that was like, you know, doing like educational work as well. Right. Which I don't know, maybe this doesn't like, because I mean, it's hard sometimes to translate some of the debates that we're having on the left to other countries, because like, Victor, like this is like a real crazy fight that we get every day within the U.S. left. Is like this kind of tension between action and study, right? I mean, yeah. I think that's a universal reality, but there's a kind of like overcorrection that some people do, which is like, okay, well, we just need to do all action and no kind of analysis.
Right. Yeah. And the thing is like, it's hard, right? Like I'm glad like MTST seems to have found a solution to that, because I would have never been able to come up with a solution to that. Like, you know what I mean? Like it's a complicated question, like looking at a picture and trying to like figure out what is the best entry point as opposed to, you know, like looking at something that has already found an entry point and understanding that it's successful, right? It's something that it's easy to identify once it's done, but before it happens, like, I don't know if I would have been able to say like, we should organize like landless workers and that will yield us a robust workers movement. Like,
yeah,
of course not. Like, no one,
yeah, exactly.
It's not like a way you do politics, you know. Like, I think the way you do politics is like you meet people where they need, and you know, at least in my idea, like when you identify like that a group, a collective of people have a need, they're probably already like working together to find a solution, and which is kind of like what Bolus did, right? Like, he saw like, fuck, like this homelessness shit is like super fucked up. And then he saw that there were people who were like already doing that, and he just joined them, you know what I mean? Like, and that's it. Like, my advice, whatever's worth, probably not much, is like, don't try to create like the new movement, but just, you know, see where there's interesting thing happening and join them, and you know, infuse it with politics, right? Like, just don't be like a guy who brings a theory and you know, lectures everyone about it, but you know, understand like what's happening, what the material needs are, understand, like, think like how that relates to the theory, and address the material needs in a theoretically sound way. Like, sounds super simple, like, as I pontificated, obviously is like a million times more complicated in reality.
Yeah, I mean, there's something so satisfying about theory as it emerges. Like, there's this section here. Let me just share the screen. Another limit was summed up by Jose Mujica, former president of Uruguay. It is in a kind of self-criticism of the Latin American left. He once said that our governments have created consumers, not citizens. The popular masses had access to some consumer goods, which is fine, but there was no simultaneous contestation of social values. Now, that's like a sort of theoretical understanding, but that's arrived at, I think, very practically. Yeah. And I, it's someone that I can't, like, we used to talk about all the time, even on Left Reckoning, right? Like the Trump administration, now the Biden administration, they'll put checks out the door to keep spending a little bit mm-hmm, up, mm-hmm. but, and maybe we'll see what happens with, like, for instance, the stimulus package, but will they protect like people's right to vote? Will they protect, will they enhance people's ability to organize their workplace? That stuff all, that's a much hairier question when it comes to the type of forces that people deal with in Brazil or America.
It's like they can, like, they're like willing to help us access these commodities, but they're not willing to decommodify these services, right?
Yeah.
Which, but again, like, you know, like in 2002, when Lula was like putting all this stuff in place, all of us are like, fuck yeah, you know, like, and it's only like after it's been happening for 20 years that you're able to look at it and say like, maybe like, you know, it was good, but there was like problems with it. And that is like the other thing, like you have to constantly like, you know, gather feedback in, like rethink. And then it's a constant like cycle of, you know, synthesis and thesis and thesis, and
yeah.
synthesis, you know, like that's how laughing theory works.
Yeah.
And you can't just like arrive at a conclusion and you know, frame it and be like, this is what our programs has to be. You have to like constantly update and re-update it.
And it almost feels like there's something inevitable, and it's like a growing pain where people are going to have to realize that, yeah, you can't, you need that. You need the theory, but you also need to like put it through tests and trials in the real world. And then it will mean something, but people that section about like, yeah, the naivety of thinking you're armed with it. You just need everyone else to realize the theories and understands you do. I mean, that really, that's familiar.
Yeah. I you know, and again, like I'm a big proponent of political education, not as much for actually the sense of convincing folks, but actually like for like making us like self-aware of what we're doing. Right. And that's how you get, like, you get a movement that's self-aware of like the activities that it's engaged in. And it changes the game. And look, it takes somebody spending a lot of time, like thinking about history from the grand scale, like Wolos has spent, to be able to look at society and say like, okay, well, this movement here seems to be challenging the right structures in society. This is what I want to get involved in. I just want to add too, because that Mojica quote there, you know, that's coming in a section sort of criticizing PT and Lula, which, but you know, just for folks who aren't familiar, it's like, you know, basically the criticism is that you have this incredible reduction in poverty, right? That certainly changes people's lives, but yeah, it doesn't fundamentally change, you know, the entire board, right? You're still operating in a certain system. And that's something that, at least from my understanding of conversations that Michael had had with Lula, that Lula has sort of been, you know, self-critical about as well. Because like the hope, at least from what I understand with Lula and the strategy there, was we can find a way to like, let's make sure that the economy is functioning well. And then we can do programs for the poor. And maybe the rich people won't, you know, do what they do anytime a left-wing movement comes into power and try to fucking destroy it. And what Lula, you know, finds later is that they did everything for the fucking rich people, and they're still pissed that, as Lula says, you know, they've turned the airport into a bus station, right? You know, they've basically given people opportunity who didn't have it. And I think it's shown by the fact that the likelihood of a PSOL, PT, you know, kind of synthesis and alliance, at least in the upcoming election on some level, might show a kind of deeper sense of militancy. But that's just my
which was the crux of the split of the PT-PSOL split. I mean, mm-hmm. of course, like it is like infused with like egos and
you know, of course, yeah,
particular all of that stuff. But the synthesis is that like PSOL, the guys who went left PT to create PSOL, thought that like PT was like becoming too neoliberal and too accepting of the established order, which perhaps you can discuss like to what extent the PSOL guys were right or wrong, but it is you know, in a way the same criticism that Mujica is doing, mm-hmm. just from another angle.
And I think that's the exciting moment that we're in right now. It's like there's a lot of self-reflection. I wanted to share before we leave, and thank you so much, Victor. Victor sent us this really badass picture that if you get nothing from this, at least let this inspire you a little bit to be a little bit more of a badass. Bowles right there in the middle, which that's an extremely powerful picture. Victor, thanks so much for joining us. It's always such a treat. And, you know, I'm sure we'll be having more and more conversations as things start to develop. You know, the thing, whenever I talk about Brazil with you or anybody, I always feel a little bit bipolar, just because it's like there's a lot of shit that's really, really bad. And then you start to see the early spring of something much, much more beautiful. So yeah. Good luck, solidarity.
Of dialectics. Yeah. I like how we got a little bit into theory this time around. Maybe.
Yeah, we should do more of it next time. Well, everybody, we will see you next Tuesday for my Griscom stream, and then you'll see us next Wednesday as well. See y'all soon.
Bye.